This is Jeffrey Tucker again. I'm here with yet another economist to talk about our new edition of Economics in One Lesson. We're covering two more chapters. The economist in question is Peter Klein. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Jeff. It's great to be here.
And the two chapters we're talking about, well, the first one begins with the title Parity Prices.
Right.
Parity Prices. I haven't heard this term in modern journalism anymore. What's up with this?
Right. This is a term that I guess it's a little bit archaic. You still see it in the technical economics literature, what they call purchasing power parity.
All right.
Parity just meaning equality or sameness. So the concern that Hazlitt was dealing with in the 1940s is the worry that that certain groups, farmers, for example, would lose purchasing power if the prices of the goods and services that they produce, commodities, for example, did not maintain their parity from year to year. So sort of a general the concern Hazlitt's dealing with is the fear that prices will fall and that therefore sellers of those commodities will be harmed and that that will have negative effects on other sectors of the economy and so on. So it's basically a plea to keep prices up.
It turns out to not be that much of a consideration anymore, partly because of inflation, right?
Exactly. We don't worry too much about falling prices.
Right.
Where we do see prices falling in industries like telecommunications, computers, of course, we think it's a great thing. I mean, think of what a personal computer cost in 1980 or 1985 compared to what you got, $2,000, $2,500, $3,000 or something that, you know, doesn't have the computing power of the cheapest cell phone today, and you can get a PC for $500 today. That's, of course, vastly greater than anything you could have gotten in 1980. Hazlitt actually uses a numerical example like that with automobiles and shows how the real cost of producing automobiles has fallen and how we would think it was a horrible thing if we had to pay in today's dollars the equivalent of what we paid for a Model T Ford and to get that kind of quality, because we simply wouldn't pay for that quality today. So in general, prices falling is a good thing. It means an increase in productivity.
So that I understand the argument. The argument concerning purchasing power is slightly different from the point that it's bad for the industry for prices to fall, because it is difficult to do business and under falling price conditions.
That's right.
So talk first about this purchasing power point. What does it mean?
Right. What he has in mind is the idea that a particular group in society, let's say that I am in the plumbing business,
okay,
and let's say that for some reason the demand for plumbing services falls and the market price of plumbing services goes down. I, as a plumber, have a hard time making ends meet.
Okay.
In general, you might say, well, that's a sad thing, Peter. We're sorry for you. Maybe you should consider another line of work.
Right.
But I, as a plumber, and my plumber friends might go to the state, I go to the American people, and I say, pity the plight of the poor plumbers. Wow, that takes a lot of alliteration. And, if we don't have plumbers, then, society can't get by without plumbing, and we're a vital part of the American system, and so on.
Your spending habits, or just a critical link in
our existence, and also our spending. In other words, if the plumbers go out of business, then they won't be spending money on the goods and services the plumbers buy, and there'll be some sort of ripple effect throughout the whole economy. So essentially, it ends up being a kind of protectionist argument.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that even though this term, where we see the term parity as in purchasing power parity, where that appears today, it's more in the international trade and macroeconomics literature. I mean, this is in a series of chapters in which Hazlitt is talking about different kinds of protectionism,
yes,
special interest group politics. And he has, in particular, groups like agricultural producers in mind, that the call for agricultural producers to use government policy to keep prices from falling is just another form of special privilege for one particular group.
Yeah.
A politically connected group.
I must say that when you're presenting the argument, it's not inherently implausible, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, it's absolutely true that when plumbers or farmers, let's say, are economically successful and doing well,
right,
they have money to spend on other goods and services, and there are certainly positive effects throughout the economy. But remember, there's a difference between the overall condition of the economy and the condition of one particular sector.
Yeah.
And if we use government policy to keep prices artificially high for farmers, well, that means higher prices that consumers pay for food, less money that those consumers have to spend on goods and services and so on. It's really just, it all goes back to the basic lesson of the book, The Broken Window Fallacy.
Right. Okay.
The argument that if we don't protect the farmers, the economy will collapse is no different from the argument that you know, what's good for one particular piece of the economy is necessarily good for all of it. You know, it's the broken window all over
again. It's also interesting, isn't it, that so much of this, I don't know if you would call it Keynesian macroeconomic theorizing or whatever it is behind there. It's partially Keynesian, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good out of the experience of the Great Depression, right, when it was widely believed that the falling prices were causing...
Yes.
Yeah.
No, that's absolutely right.
Right. Okay.
And I mean, it makes sense... In a sort of common sense intuitive way, if I'm a business person and the prices, you know, and I can't get a high price for the products that I sell, well, clearly that's bad for me. And that's, you know, I'm in poor economic shape if I can't get a high price for the things that I want to exchange on the
right
market. But it doesn't follow from that that it's not the fact that prices are falling for my goods and services that is the cause of, you know, some sort of general economic, you know, economic problems.
Right.
Right? I mean, the falling prices are a result of, in this case, falling demand for the
right
services of plumbers or the commodities produced by farmers or the salaries, services of economics professors or whatever
right
it might be. So it's a confusion of cause and effect.
And, you know, it's interesting, too, how what's behind this macroeconomic theorizing is contrary to the interest of consumers, because as consumers, you always
absolutely
want to pay a lower price.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah.
That's right. And we're all producers and consumers
right
in a sense. And it's just like any other, you know, a tariff to protect the steel industry, for example. If
right
you look only at the steel industry, it looks
right
like, wow, higher prices for steel, higher profits, they can pay yeah their workers more, and so on and so forth.
Many people made that mistake.
Exactly. And
yeah
you forget about the fact that all the users of steel are
right
paying higher prices, and that those effects, essentially, it's not just that they cancel each other out and are neutral, but the effects of the protectionist policy are actually harmful in terms of, you know, distorting the allocation of resources throughout the economy, directing resources artificially toward one particular sector
right
and away from others, according to the wishes of consumers as they spend.
Say, would this be an example of this fallacy at work? The argument that Walmart shouldn't come to a city, come to a community,
sure,
because look what happens. You know, the local merchants.
Absolutely.
You know, okay, so it's a version of the same kind of
right
argument. They'll have to lower the prices, then we'll be able to make a profit, and they have to go out of business, and Walmart takes
that's
it.
And remember, yeah, you know, Hazlitt's one lesson, that you have to see the whole the whole story, the whole part, and the whole system, and not just one part.
Yeah.
And of course, if we look at a mom-and-pop business that cannot compete with a more efficient, more effective, more productive Walmart, of course it's sad for that mom-and-pop industry. But if we stop the analysis there, we've lost the most important part,
right
right? Namely, that everybody else is actually much better off
yeah
with the presence of a store like Walmart.
Right. Evidently so, right? Or else they wouldn't go.
That's absolutely
they
right
wouldn't go, and Walmart would go out of business.
It's interesting that you mention Walmart, because the next chapter in the book
okay
is titled Saving the X Industry.
So the themes tie together.
Exactly. Same
okay
theme, where he gives lots of examples of industries, steel, automobiles, whatever it is, that claim to have a special standing in the economy. They're particularly important for economic prosperity. If this industry were to fall, well, then the dominoes will
milk
begin to
or
collapse.
Whatever.
You know,
yeah. Shoes, what would we be without shoes?
And of course, it's very cleverly
yeah
named Saving the X Industry, because
yeah
you can fill in the blank any way you
yeah
like. You know, today, of course, it's the banking industry and the home mortgage industry. And oh my goodness, if we let Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae collapse, well, then something else will collapse, and then the whole financial system will go under. If we don't do something to stop foreclosures, all these people who lose their homes due to foreclosure, you know, their you know, economic condition will lead to these spillover effects to sort of the rest of the economy and so on. It was the same thing after 9/11. Remember the airline industry and
sure
the insurance industry.
We won't be able to visit our families across over on the West Coast.
Right? It's the same thing. And the point is, you know, every argument like that, you know, ultimately boils down to some kind of special pleading why the state should favor my industry as opposed to other industries at the expense of other industries in the economy. The reason I had a seg to that from Walmart is because I was thinking about this argument. People who say we need to protect homeowners, we need to protect banks, we need
right
to protect particular investment firms that bet heavily on these mortgage-backed securities and,
right
and made the wrong bet.
Yeah.
You know, Walmart is a great example of a company that, you know, to the mass of consumers that it serves is, of course, heroic, but to most intellectuals, professors, journalists, and so on is a sort of, you know, symptom of the evil of capitalism driving out the little guy and so on. But I think, suppose Walmart were to be in financial hardship, suppose Walmart were to declare bankruptcy or be on the verge of collapse, Do you think the same members of the intelligentsia would be crying for the government to prop up Walmart, to save Walmart? Because it really is true. Think of all these small rural communities that are served by Walmart and little else. If Walmart were to disappear right away, masses of people throughout rural America and elsewhere in the world would be much worse off. Yeah. But I bet you wouldn't see the calls for Walmart Walmart is so politically. Oh, yeah, it could be. See, certainly could be. And, of course, there is a, there are extra economic arguments typically brought into these kind of saving the X industry stories with steel or automobiles. Oh, people might make a national defense argument. If we don't have a healthy U.S. steel industry, if we buy all our steel from Korea or from Japan, well, my gosh, what happens if the East Asians declare war on us? We won't have enough steel to build tanks and so on. In the case of agriculture, people say, well, agriculture is special somehow. It's part of the fabric of American society, the Jeffersonian ideal. We need to have this sector has to be strong. It's important to have a strong agricultural sector, even if it's not purely for economic reasons, but just for sort of moral, spiritual, inspirational reasons. In fact, you do see that policy much more explicit in Europe, for example, where, agriculture, having beautiful little, communities, it's like rural France, it's like Disneyland, right? So the people who live in Paris and the big cities want to have the beautiful countryside to escape to, and they want to see a guy with a plow or a pitchfork, the yeoman farmer in his little cottage, because it's part of the scenery. It looks pretty. It's not a purely economic story. It's sort of a political and social story as well.
And it's why they keep out these big stores, big discount stores.
Absolutely. Would ruin the landscape. That's exactly right.
Meanwhile, unemployment's very high.
I've actually heard about a case where a place in Europe where they're popular biking routes, and where some local governments have put up fake cows and horses up on the hillside so that when the bikers are going by, they look off and they see this pastoral scene with the horses and the cows and so on, but they're actually just made of cardboard and they're off in the distance on the mountaintop to make it look more romantic.
A burgeoning local industry, the manufacturer of cardboard cows.
You might think they would wonder at some point why the cows never move.
Can I ask you something about the whole question of falling prices?
Of course.
And doing business under falling prices. You mentioned the computer industry earlier. Mm-hmm. What are the kinds of challenges that an industry faces under these conditions?
Sure. Well, it's extremely difficult because you not only have prices falling, but just the fact that prices are so uncertain, right? It's much easier to run to be in business as an undertaker, where demand and supply conditions are relatively stable, than it is to be in a rapidly changing industry like IT, where there's all sorts of technological innovations coming down the road. On the other hand, we have to keep in mind, when we talk about falling prices in the computer business, for example, it's not just the price of the PCs that Dell or Apple or HP or Lenovo sell to consumers, but also the prices of the intermediate products that go into the computer are falling as well.
For the final manufacturers are paying less for the products.
Absolutely. Right. Okay. So it would be bad for Dell if output prices were falling, but input prices remained the same.
Right.
Then Dell would be in an increased, there would be a squeeze. But of course, the prices of memory and hard drives and the LCD screens, right, all of the components, those prices are falling
too.
But
you have to be very careful about inventory then, don't you?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that one of the factors that it's just an extreme attachment to the whole question of you have to just have very good short-term forecasts?
No, I think that's exactly right. Because if the manufacturer were to stock up on a bunch of components when the component prices are high and not use them until the price of the computers has fallen, it would be a difficult thing. But that's why we see in industries like that a move towards the sort of, just-in-time manufacturing model where inventories are kept very low, precisely because there's so much price volatility. And of course, Jeff, remember there are other things that businesses can do. They can try to reduce price variability through long-term contracts with suppliers and with customers. Uh-huh. So, companies like computer companies like Dell, for example, most of their business is not simply sales to computers, but sales to large companies, government agencies, universities, and so on. And they often have long-term contracts with those clients, which can, where some prices can be specified ahead of time. So, of course, doing business in a highly volatile sector of the economy is challenging, but there are many opportunities there as well.
It leads to increases in efficiency, doesn't it?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, we as consumers, we just sit and enjoy the ride, yeah. right? Ultimately, it doesn't matter to me a lot whether it's Dell or Lenovo yeah. or HP or whoever manufacturing the computer. I mean, my goodness, look what I get. Look at all the goodies I get to consume. They're competing with each other dog eat dog in a highly competitive world in which their margins are getting smaller and right. smaller. But hey, it's great for the consumer.
And it must be good for them ultimately. Else they, I mean, they could easily leave the industry, right? There's nothing forcing anybody to be a computer
exactly.
manufacturer.
That's exactly
and the
right.
same is true in other industries. Agriculture?
Sure.
We could it would survive under falling prices.
I mean, an additional problem with the argument for propping up Industry X is that it sort of locks locks us into the way the economy is at the point that that legislation comes into place, where we may wish things to be completely different.
Right.
So the obvious example that I use in class all the time is imagine that if we had, when the automobile first came around, if we had special protection for horseshoe manufacturers, blacksmiths, the people who scooped up after the animals in the roads and so on, sure, it would be good for people who are employed in that sector, but how would you like to be riding a horse and, driving a horse-drawn buggy today as opposed to the automobile? I mean, the point is with the computer business, I mean, again, think how rapidly things change. Who knows what kind of computing devices the market will give us in 20 years, 10 years, even 5 years. If we were to try to sort of keep things the way they are right now to have some short-term stability, we might lose out in a huge way in the long term.
So how would you speculate what would happen to the housing industry if prices yeah. just continue to fall? What
sure.
happens?
No, I mean, look, there are a couple different possibilities. I mean, if sort of current if people's preferences for how they live and where they live and so on were to remain basically unchanged, well, there's going to be a demand for housing, right? Now, on the margin, some people who own their own homes might prefer to own condominiums or to be renters and so on. But, it isn't the case that we're all going to start living in these massive, collective apartment buildings where we live in family units of 1,000 people each or something like that. So presumably the sort of rough distribution of people between living in single-family homes versus apartments and so on probably wouldn't change that much, but there might be different entrepreneurs building the houses, different financial institutions funding the houses,
and there might different be different financial
might
terms.
Be different people living in the houses. Yeah. Sure, I mean it's one thing that is so frustrating about the current mortgage bailout is how grossly unfair it is to people of modest means who didn't buy a house because yeah. they thought it was more financially prudent to rent, for example, and their friends of equal means who sort of recklessly purchased a house that they couldn't afford and yeah. signed an adjustable rate mortgage they didn't really understand and are now getting a subsidy check
yeah.
or are getting some kind of protection to bail them out. It's really unfair to the person who didn't make that choice.
Right.
So we would see some differences, to be sure.
And the renter who's out on the housing market
yeah, that's right.
would probably
that's
appreciate
right.
housing prices that
have fallen
a little bit more already.
Yeah. I mean, Jeff, you could turn the question around the other way and say, To the person who advocates the subsidy, the protection, the bailout,
yeah.
essentially they're arguing that market forces don't work in this particular case.
Right.
That, just as we had a horse and buggy industry at one point, and now we have an automobile industry, and there was a transition as technology changed, as new resources became available, as consumer preferences changed, we had a rapid, sudden, dynamic shift from having one type of industry being prominent to having a new industry being prominent. Same thing with computers and aerospace and lots of other industries that we see. Well, if that's a bad thing, if we don't think the market can adequately meet people's demands and can adequately adjust for changes in for technological breakthroughs, well, I think the burden of proof ought to be on the critic to explain why the market doesn't work in that case.
Yeah.
Why can't the free market handle housing? Why can't the free market handle food? Why can't the free market handle automobiles or clothing or computers or anything else? Instead, usually the burden is put on the defender of the market to explain why this regulation isn't needed.
Right.
Well, okay, fine. That's the world we're in. That's the game we have to play.
And
but sometimes it's fun to turn it around
yeah.
and put the shoe on the other foot.
And isn't it interesting how we're somehow only now paying the price for this policy that began sometime after World War II?
Absolutely.
Isn't it remarkable?
And again, I think there's an extra economic aspect to this, too. There's this sort of romantic notion of the post-war baby boom notion of the high house and the white picket fence and the 2.5 kids and the car in the garage and so on. And of course, that's a wonderful thing. And there's nothing wrong with having that sort of vision, each of us individually having one vision or another of how we want to live. But the use of government policy to promote one particular lifestyle, one particular housing choice, doesn't seem to be justified.
And when Hazlitt speaks about thinking about the long-term implications of policies, in this case, the long-term is something like 60 years.
That's
right?
Absolutely right.
Remarkable.
That's right. And again, we have to, that's another, as you do well to remind us that Hazlitt, when he talks about looking at the big picture, it's, you know, the overall economy at any one point in time, and also looking at the long-run consequences. Again, think of housing. Sort of the legislation that's just working its way through Congress now, right? This massive bailout policy.
Trillions.
They're not at all looking at the obvious long-run consequence of encouraging irresponsible behavior. I don't know what else to call it. Right. Anytime you have an industry like housing, airlines, automobiles, whatever it is, that is perceived to be, quote, too big to fail, anytime there's an implicit government guarantee to protect you and if you run into hard times, well, of course that's going to affect behavior, right? The economists call that moral hazard, but in layman's terms, we would call it, irresponsible or inappropriate behavior. Right. Sure, of course, if I know my downside is covered, I'm going to engage in a lot more risky behavior than I would if I had to bear the consequences of my own action. And people talking about this legislation today, most of its advocates, are completely ignoring these long-run consequences of encouraging malinvestment in the future. Because, the taxpayer is always going to come and pick up the tab.
Well, we've got the solution. Read the book.
Absolutely. Right? Highly recommend it to all of your viewers.
Thank you for explaining all this to us, Peter.
My pleasure. Great to be with you, Jeff.
Okay.